Hello, you are listening to an episode of Trade Talks, a podcast about the economics of trade policy. I'm Samaya Keynes, the US Economics and Trade Editor for The Economist.
And I'm Chad Bown, a Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
In this episode, we're going to explain how finance matters for trade. You might think that borrowing, credit, finance, that they all work in the background, but there is a growing body of research that shows that it matters a lot.
We'll be joined by Professor Kalina Manova at University College London. Kalina is one of the main sources of that research. For more than a decade, she's been exploring how the inability of companies to borrow money can impact trade and even economic development.
Kalina is going to tell us about stock markets, the global financial crisis, China, and a whole lot more. Kalina, hi.
Hi, great to join you guys.
Great to have you. Okay, let's start, Kalina, by doing some corporate finance and trade 101. Suppose I'm a chief executive of a company and I want my company to trade, to export. Why do I need cash?
All firms routinely rely on outside finance in order to produce and operate and sell. Why? Because they need to borrow to cover the gap between the time when they have to spend money and the time when they actually get paid for what they sell. So here are some examples. Some of those costs, you just incur one-off upfront, they're fixed. And that's stuff like spending on R&D and product design, marketing, research and advertising, or investing in fixed capital equipment. Some costs do scale up and down as you adjust your production level. So you might need to pay some of your salaried workers upfront, or you're buying input purchases to produce.
That makes sense, but that seems to apply to all companies. How is exporting different?
To enter a new market, you have to do your market research and identify your foreign buyers. You have to set up your distribution network and maintain it. You might need to adjust your product to the specific needs of that foreign market or the specific market regulations of that destination. On top of that, you have to incur transportation costs. You might face import duties, tariffs, non-tariff duties, and the such. And this is just one of three reasons why exporters need more finance. So, okay, they have more costs. On top of that, they actually have a longer gap between the time when they face these costs and the time when they get paid, because international transactions take, on average, 60 days longer to process. It can vary anywhere between 1 to 3 months. And about a third of that is clearly customs and logistics at the export dock. About a third of that is clearing customs and logistics at the import dock. And the rest is just transit in the middle.
And so this extra period of time between production and when you're getting paid, you need to be able to finance that somehow. That's essentially what the issue is for exporters.
That's exactly right. They need to bridge the gap between the time when they have to pay for all the inputs they need to produce, all their workers, all their equipment, and the time when the foreign buyer will ultimately receive those goods and pay them for them.
What's the third extra challenge that exporters face?
The third challenge is that foreign transactions are intrinsically much riskier than domestic transactions. Some of that has to do with stuff going wrong in the logistical process. Some of it is exchange rate risk. Some of it is just weak contracting across borders and just not knowing what jurisdiction to turn to in case anything goes wrong.
Okay, so we've agreed that I'm the CEO of Trade Talks, Inc.
Exporting podcasts around the world.
Exporting podcasts around the world. And I really need cash. But let's be a little bit more specific and say that I'm the head of a company that operates only within one country. So I'm not a multinational. I'm just an exporter. How do I get cash?
So some of the costs you face, you're going to pay out of your internal cash flows from operations. That's obvious. You might have some retained earnings from previous years as well that you can tap. But
all that podcast revenue.
All that podcast revenue, exactly. But the moment you start looking at external sources of financing, you can go to the bank and get a loan. So that's sort of debt financing. If you're a pretty large company, you can obviously rely on some more stock equity sources of funding. What's interesting is that you can also rely on some buyer-supplier trade credit. For any transaction, you can agree the payment terms with your buyer. They can pay you after they receive what you sell them. That's called post-shipment payment. But if they have deeper pockets than you, they can choose to pay you up front. That's called cash in advance. And that way, your problem is solved, and they have to deal with it. That's true for any transaction, domestic or international. In the case of international trade, there is actually another arrangement. It's called bank letter of credit. That's essentially when I talk to my bank, you talk to your bank, and the two banks figure it out between themselves. So essentially, you go through a bank intermediary such that neither me nor you has to face any liquidity constraints. But of course, we pay a haircut for that service.
All right, so now let's assume we're a multinational company with subsidiaries in both the UK and the US. As that massive multinational, what extra financing options do I have?
Multinationals are extremely important. They mediate two-thirds of global trade. About one-third of international trade is between two affiliates of the same multinational company that are located in different countries. And another one-third is between one multinational company and some unrelated firm elsewhere. So how they finance themselves is by arbitraging cross-country differences in the cost of capital. What that means is that any firm can access finance in the country where it's located, but multinationals have a foothold in multiple countries. And so they can, in principle, borrow in all these different locations. If the cost of capital is lower in one country, say in the US, you can try to raise a lot of money there and use it to fund the operations of all your affiliates in the rest of the world.
So what's parent financing?
That's effectively when the headquarters of a multinational that are, say, based in the US have access to relatively cheap finance. They raise it in the US, and then they fund the operations of their affiliates in a foreign country, say in China or in Africa. And so that just happens by the parent extending direct financing to the affiliate abroad.
And of course, if you've got subsidiaries in lots of different locations, you might think that many more capital markets would be open to you. So if you're an American company only, it might be trickier for you to access British sources of finance than if you also had a British subsidiary.
That's exactly right. It's always easier to raise finance in a country where you have local operations. And that's partly because local financiers can monitor what you're doing and they know what's happening with their money. They can just walk into your production plant and look around and say, okay, that's decent collateral. If something goes wrong, I can come and grab this.
So it sounds like it's much easier if you're a multinational.
That's right. Multinationals do have access to cheaper capital on average because they can choose to raise it in different countries. Domestic firms are just stuck borrowing from the local market. In a country with very weak domestic financial institutions, multinationals are definitely going to be less constrained than the domestic firms. But having said that, it's not the case that multinationals are altogether unconstrained. And the reason for it is because not all lenders are happy to fund operations abroad. They don't observe what's happening in the foreign market. They don't have monitoring and control over that. And if contract enforcement is pretty weak in this foreign market, they might worry about their investment being expropriated should anything go wrong. This is especially true for countries in the developing world that are subject to not just economic risk, but also political risks. So at the end of the day, what multinationals do is try to fund their operations locally, where their affiliates are based. So affiliates try to raise finance in their host country. If that fails or is too expensive, they try to get some help from the parent through additional parent financing. But overall, this parent financing doesn't fully compensate for the shortfall in locally available finance.
Okay, Kalina, how should we think about differences between sectors and which ones rely more on this type of external finance?
Sectors do differ a lot in how much they need to invest in R&D. This is just one example of an upfront expenditure, but it gives you a sense of the reliance on external finance. If you look at electronic and scientific equipment, that's an industry that heavily relies on upfront R&D expenditures. If you think about pharmaceuticals, it takes ages to develop a drug before you can bring it to market. So those kind of sectors have a very high reliance on external finance. At the opposite spectrum are things with a very quick turnaround. Think about the textile and apparel industry, for example. This tells you how much external finance you need. But sectors also differ in how easy it is for them to get that outside finance. You go to a bank and you try to borrow some money, the bank is going to ask for some collateral. If you're operating in an industry such as petroleum or something very intensive in heavy machinery, you're going to be able to pledge all that collateral. You'll say, I have all these machines. If my product fails, you can just seize my assets. Conversely, if you are in some of these very R&D, high-tech intensive sectors, you don't have those kind of collateralizable assets. You basically have a bunch of smart engineers in a room working on the next iPad product. And so asset tangibility is another important dimension that tells you not just how much finance you need, but how much finance you can get.
There's all these differences that companies have in terms of their access to finance. How do we know that it actually matters?
So we've just discussed that countries differ in the strength of their financial institutions and how well developed their financial markets are. We also said sectors differ in their reliance on the financial system. You put the two together and that's your classic comparative advantage story. So at a very intuitive level, if you are in an industry that needs a ton of external financing, you'll be better off if you're located in a country that has well-developed financial markets.
So the idea is that basically, access to finance can be a source of comparative advantage.
That's exactly right. And that is also something that we can formally test. We can take that to the data and see whether indeed countries with much stronger financial institutions or countries that implement financial reforms see a rise in their overall export activity and whether that rise is even bigger in the sectors you expect it to be.
Any examples?
In one paper, I cited the effect of equity market liberalizations. These are reforms to the stock market that allow foreigners to invest in the economy. And this is a way to bring in extra capital in the country and potentially improve the access of domestic firms to that capital. So what I find is that on average, these kind of equity market reforms increase aggregate exports by about 40%. That's a pretty big change. And this is even accounting for concurrent trade reforms and other determinants of capital flows.
That isn't the only paper you've written, right? Tell us about another one.
So in other work, I've tried to understand whether long-term differences in financial institutions also affect trade patterns. In another project, I looked at 107 countries between 1995 and 1995, and I tried to understand how cross-country differences in financial contracting and the total amount of finance available to the private sector shape these countries' export activity. And what I found was that there were really, really large effects. What's important here is that access to finance doesn't just help firms produce more. 75 to 80% of the overall effect on trade is, in fact, trade-specific. It's above and beyond the overall rise in total production.
Okay, so breaking it down, it could be that good financial institutions support higher production in general, and then that just comes along with higher trade. Or it could be that trade is helped disproportionately, that there's something special that these institutions seem to do to increase trade. And you find that mostly it's actually a trade-specific effect. So trade is growing above and beyond what you would expect given this general increase in output.
That's exactly right. And the magnitudes are quite large. If you think about the overall growth in trade activity between 1985 and 1995, financial development alone explains 22% of that expansion. And in comparison, changes in total investment or skill accumulation in the economy can explain only about 12%. So the magnitudes are large, both in absolute terms and relative to other economic factors driving trade growth.
Do you see major differences across sectors?
Absolutely. Financially dependent sectors that have more of these upfront expenditure needs respond a lot more to financial development. So when the overall financial institutions become stronger, exports increase much faster in the financially sensitive industries. And in terms of magnitudes, compare a sector that needs a lot of external finance to one that is not so reliant. The difference in performance can be as much as 20 to 30%.
We've spoken about the volume of exports. Are there any other impacts of this expansion in access to credit on companies?
One important result is that financially developed countries can export to more destinations. And the reason this matters is because demand shocks are not synchronized across countries. So if you sell to just one market, you're extremely dependent on what's happening in that country. But if you're exporting to 10, 20, 30 countries, you can diversify. You can hedge that risk a lot better. So what I find is that countries that export to more destinations do in fact have higher GDP per capita growth, but also a lot less aggregate volatility. And the same is true for their export flows. They experience faster export growth and less export volatility over time.
Are there any differences depending on where a company is in the supply chain? Are there any differences in terms of how all of this finance stuff matters if you're thinking about a company perhaps right in the middle of a supply chain, just doing one little piece of it, versus if you're the big multinational coordinating all the research and development and organizing the whole production chain?
Take the iPhone example. If you're a firm producing in China, you can choose to design a phone, manufacture all the inputs, assemble them, and then sell that product. Alternatively, if you're Foxconn choosing to produce iPhones and iPads for Apple, you only do the intermediate steps of the assembly process. And in fact, Apple sends you all the expensive inputs for free. So if you compare these two companies, they have very different financing needs. The more production steps you need to complete in-house, the more external finance you need to raise. What that means is that credit-constrained firms are more likely to select into just the intermediate steps of the production process. So I was interested in understanding how this plays out in China, where this form of processing trade, completing just intermediate steps of production, is extremely important. That's responsible for half of the gross value of Chinese exports. And I found very strong evidence that financially constrained firms do indeed perform much more processing trade than the ordinary form of trade. They are also a lot less profitable. So financial constraints end up restricting firms to low value-added segments of the production process that are also less profitable.
So these supply chains have meant that firms in developing countries have been able to participate, but credit constraints mean, unfortunately, that they're in the lower value-added, less profitable parts of the supply chain because they don't have access to the financing necessary to be in the higher value-added parts.
One of the reasons that developing countries try to attract multinationals certainly is to alleviate the local financial constraints, because these multinationals end up bringing extra capital resources to the economy. Sometimes they also interact with independent suppliers domestically, but essentially by providing inputs for free or direct financing to those suppliers, they are helping more domestic firms operate. So this is certainly one example in which global value chains and multinational activity helps poor countries overcome some of those restrictions imposed by weak financial markets at home. I've actually looked at how multinational affiliates in China compare to domestic firms. And you certainly see that foreign-owned affiliates and joint ventures export a lot more than domestic firms in the same industry, in the same region, benefiting from the same kind of local tax treatment. The differences also do vary across sectors. And so those same sources of variation we discussed earlier manifest here as well. So multinational affiliates are less constrained and they have a comparative advantage in the sectors that need more external finance.
Okay, we have just spoken about a lot of different papers. Now I want to focus on one paper in particular, your paper on the global financial crisis. To give a teaser of the result, there were big effects on trade.
Kalina, what happened?
In the global financial crisis, trade collapsed. And it collapsed very abruptly, and it fell by a lot more than overall GDP production. In 2009, world trade had declined by 12%. In comparison, global GDP was down only 5.5%.
So that then leads to the question, what happened? Why did trade collapse?
There are really two leading explanations, and I think there's merit to both. On the one hand, there was a big decline in demand. people felt this financial crisis. They were poorer, they were consuming less, they were importing less. Demand for global trade fell. But at the same time, there was also a very abrupt contraction in credit supply. And what little credit was available was extremely expensive. Anecdotally speaking, the IMF, the WTO estimates that there was a trade finance gap anywhere between $25 to $500 billion in the second half of 2008.
And that means that, that gap is the gap between what firms wanted and what they could get.
And so we're left with this question then of what caused the collapse of trade? Was it demand? Or was it the lack of access to finance, which then must have constrained production and export? So what do you do to try to help us answer this question?
I studied this question looking at U.S. imports month on month. Just in October, November of 2008, exports to the U.S. fell about 20%. And in some sectors, this was as high as 30 to 50%. Interest rates were changing so quickly that it was important to look at these high-frequency adjustments in trade activity. And so I looked at U.S. imports from different countries across the world in a given sector. That means that I don't have to worry about demand conditions in the U.S. because all these different export countries were facing the same demand conditions. What made them different was that they experienced different changes in the cost of capital. And that was a reflection of both the extent to which the financial crisis affected them, but also the extent to which policymakers reacted quickly to facilitate credit availability. And the way to measure that at the high frequency, at the monthly level, is to look at the interbank interest rate. This is the rate at which banks borrow from each other to smooth out liquidity constraints overnight.
So you look to see whether countries with higher interbank lending rates and so with worse access to credit, whether they exported less to the U.S.
Exactly. And we found that countries with higher interbank interest rates exported less to the U.S. at the peak of the financial crisis.
There was a lot going on around then, in the midst of this crisis. How can you be sure that something else wasn't affecting both finance and trade?
There are two aspects to that question, really. One is to think about demand conditions in the U.S., and we're able to tackle that by looking at how different export countries are selling in the same industry, because at least we know they're all facing the same demand conditions in the U.S. Another concern you might have is that it's not just about financial conditions in the exporting countries, but it's also about other institutional changes or demand or productivity shocks in those exporting countries. So to tackle that problem, we ended up relying again on the variation across sectors. We know that some industries need a lot more external finance, and so they're more sensitive to changes in the cost of capital. We know that some sectors have an easier time raising external capital because they can offer more collateral. They have more tangible assets. And indeed, what we found was that countries that experienced higher costs of capital saw bigger declines, not just in overall sales to the U.S., but specifically in those financially dependent sectors. So that gives us a little bit more credibility that it was a financial channel rather than a demand or productivity shock at play.
So how big are these effects?
They're pretty large. So you can think about some counterfactual scenarios that didn't come to be. So different countries intervened to alleviate these credit cost spikes at different times. And you can ask, well, imagine that all governments intervened right away in the start of the crisis in September 2008, such that interest rates immediately fell down to their post-crisis level in August 2009. If that had happened, exports to the U.S. throughout this whole period would have been 30% higher than they were in practice.
Did policymakers at the time during the financial crisis realize what a big deal this actually was?
I think they did. I think there was a concerted effort to facilitate trade finance. The G20 was meeting at the peak of the crisis in November 2008, and the focus there was on agreeing to refrain from raising new barriers to trade. And as the crisis developed, the attention shifted more and more towards committing to raise more money for trade finance. So at the April 2009 G20 summit, the agreement was to raise $250 billion for trade finance.
Last question. More broadly, what should policymakers take away from this wealth of research that we've just been discussing?
Credit constraints matter, and they really matter for international trade. So I think what we learn from this whole research is that we want to encourage the development of better financial institutions. That's a long-term goal. Short-term, we want to think about overcoming problems in the current capital markets. The WTO actually allows export credit agencies to support the kind of transactions that the private sector is not willing to cover. And almost all countries have very active export credit agencies. They're always sponsored by the government. Sometimes they are state-run. Sometimes they're privately run. In practice, they end up supporting only lumpy transactions to risky markets. And I wish there was a way for more trade finance to be extended to just regular firms who operate in the economy.
I should just add here, I suppose, that lots of credit can also go wrong. So in China, I think the issue is that maybe there's been too much credit for their domestic firms. And you could question whether this was, you know, export specific or not. But you know, it's possible to go too far with this and end up propping up bad firms that are zombie-like and really should go under, and excessively easy credit is keeping them afloat.
I think that's right. And there are interesting questions about the amount of financing that's floating around, especially in economies that are very heavily reliant on the banking sector. Our measures of bank loans to the private sector as a share of total GDP sometimes reach crazy amounts, like 150%. And they're good questions to ask whether you're overshooting at that point. We don't care just about the total amount of financing available in the economy, but also how it's allocated across firms. We certainly don't want to be supporting the ones that are inefficiently using resources and essentially taking them away from more productive uses in the rest of the economy.
Kalina, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That is all for Trade Talks. A huge thank you to Kalina Manova of University College London.
And as always, a big thank you to Colin Warren, who takes care of our audio.
Follow us on Twitter. I'm at Samaya Keynes.
And I'm at Chad Bown.
And we're on @trade_talks.
That's not one but two underscores, @trade_talks.
Because when it comes to trade relationships, when you need a borrower and a lender, two is always better than one.